Okay, today is May 4th, 2019. This is Karen Brewster, and I'm here with Becky Salibi in her lovely home in Bozeman, Montana, having recently moved from Anchorage. And this is an interview for the Klondike Gold Rush National Historical Park Oral History Project. Becky, thank you for letting me come visit and get to know you a little bit and your husband, Bruce. Partially why we're interviewing you is because of your great book, Beneath the Surface, 30 Years of Historical Archaeology in Skagway, Alaska. But before we get to that, maybe tell me a little bit about yourself and your background. I know you're an archaeologist and you did work for the Park Service in Alaska, correct?
That's correct.
So what's your background?
I think most of my career I did work for the Park Service. I worked for the Park Service probably a little bit over 20 years, but I came to Alaska in 1983 after getting my two graduate degrees from the University of Oregon, and it was the first research I'd ever done, or any actually field work I had done in Alaska was, I believe it was in 76, and it was an archaeological project on Paxson Lake. Mm-hmm. And I was a young graduate student and I had never done archaeology, and I spent the whole summer there and I literally fell in love with Alaska, and I knew I had to return. So I went back to Oregon and I finished my PhD, and then literally the day that I turned it in to the graduate school, I went back to my house and I was with a friend of mine was staying with me, and she told me about a job at the University of Alaska Museum. I said, okay, I guess I better apply. So I applied, and I got the job, and I finally got to go back to Alaska. And I started working for the University of Alaska Museum on the Susitna Project, where I met my husband, Bruce Rehm. And we've lived in Alaska, well, I lived in Alaska for 36 years, and Bruce a little bit longer.
Mm-hmm. And you're... educational background, and your degrees are in archaeology?
In anthropology.
Anthropology.
Yeah, 3 degrees in anthropology.
Mm-hmm. And all your undergraduates from the University of Oregon?
My undergraduates from the University of California, Santa Barbara.
Okay. And where did you grow up?
I was born in Beirut, Lebanon, because my dad was Lebanese, but our family moved to St. Louis when I was just a baby, and I never learned Arabic. I don't speak Arabic. So I grew up in St. Louis for the first 12 years, and then my family moved to California. So I went to high school and college in California. And then when it was time for graduate school, I had a real hard time getting in because I was a bad undergraduate student. But anyway, I got better as I went along. And then I finally, after many tries, many, many tries to get in graduate school, then I think it was pretty hard to get in. I got accepted at University of Oregon, so I spent 8 years there.
Mm-hmm. And why did you decide to do archaeology?
Actually, that's a good question. I started out doing physical anthropology, and I actually took my PhD exams in physical anthropology. And I was interested in genetics. I was interested in, paleoanthropology. I was very, very interested in osteology. And I had wanted to do a dissertation on some kind of... genetic research, actually osteocraniological research in Alaska. And as I was doing the proposals for it, I realized that I probably wasn't going to be able to, maybe not even get the grant, but maybe not even get a job. And right then, I had a friend who had a very large collection of animal bones, zooarchaeological remains from the Columbia River. And he kept wanting me to come in, and he had done his dissertation on the artifacts, and he wanted me to do them on the bones. He wanted me to continue to work, and I'm realizing if I actually did this on a volunteer basis, it would probably take me 50 years. And I thought it was about time I changed from physical to archaeology. So I applied the knowledge I had of human osteology, and I learned, I guess I taught myself zooarchaeology. Yeah. Was that your question?
Well, why archaeology? What was interesting about it to you?
It was the bones. I started out with the bones, mm-hmm. and I had done field work, and I absolutely loved the field work. Mm-hmm. So it was the idea, and then the possibility of actually getting a job was, you know, I was getting near the end, not near the end, but like halfway through my graduate degree, and I thought, okay, I better just change. So I one day just said, okay, I'm going to be an archaeologist now. And I remember I was at that museum, which is the museum at the University of Oregon campus, and the director at the time was Dr. Don Dumond, and he and my advisor, Mel Akins, came in, and I'm sorting my bones, and they came in and they said, so you think you're an archaeologist? And it was like, oh, no, I'm a fake. They said, we don't think so. You have to take this class, this class, this class. And I said, it was at the beginning of the fall semester, and I said, whatever it is. And I literally ran out of the museum. I went to the registrar. I signed up for all the classes they wanted me to do. So that's how I became an archaeologist.
Okay. And what was your PhD on?
It was on the Lower Columbia River. It was the prehistoric ethnohistory and settlement patterns of the Lower Columbia River. And it was based on my friend Rick Pettigrew's collections that he had made. And like I said, he did the artifacts and I did the bones.
Okay. And so when you came to the University of Alaska Museum, and that's a Sitna project, what did you do for them?
Well, it was a big, it was a huge project, and it started in the early 80s, and this was like, the year I came was, it was 83, so it was my, maybe the second or third year, and I was one of the supervisors, which was kind of funny, because I really wasn't that well, I didn't know Alaskan archaeology as I should, as I should have at that point, because I had been doing, Oregon archaeology.
Right.
Anyway, we had various crews, and we just did huge surveys over vast portions of the Middle Susitna River. And so I would go out with the crews and, you know, dig and find sites, and we did a little bit of excavation, and not really excavation, reconnaissance survey, and then a little bit of testing are the proper mm-hmm. words. But really, I found out then that what I do best, and they certainly found out for me, is that fieldwork is not my forte. I'm a researcher and a writer. So I helped do the research and the writing, and that's what I sort of have been doing ever since.
So you helped write up the reports and things.
Yeah.
And for people who don't know, the Susitna Project, it was a big dam proposal.
Yeah.
And so they were doing kind of like archaeological clearance almost.
Yes. On a
baseline research.
Exactly. Huge areas. And we got dropped off by helicopter, and we would just survey all day long. And it was wonderful. I loved being out there. And then I loved it even more when I got to go into the lab and look at the bones and do the research, because that's what I consider myself to be, a researcher and a writer.
Yeah, and that was a period that, thanks to the Susitna Project, there was a lot of funding for all kinds of projects.
Oh, well, that funding went on for a number of years, and then it finally dried up, and of
right.
course the dam never got built. But recently it's something that they've talked about again, and I have to always kind of laugh when I think about it. But it's, as far as I know, it's not, nothing is happening.
Right.
In terms of the dam being
right.
built.
But it was fortunate that so much archaeological surveying
yes.
was able to be accomplished
right.
because of that.
Right. And I think there was lots of criticism about the Jim Dixon and his research methods and all that. But I found them to be just fine. And I think that he was very thorough. And I think that there was so much that was learned. And so much really baseline information that was not known about the archaeology of that in central Alaska. I could not be more positive about it in my own mind.
Mm-hmm. And now, was Jim the lead archaeologist
yeah.
on the project?
Yeah, Dr. E. James Dixon.
Yeah.
He was a curator of archaeology at the University of Alaska Museum. And his associate was George Smith.
Okay. So what happened after the Susitna Project ended?
For the museum or for me personally?
For you, personally.
Okay, so Bruce and I were both working on that. My husband, Bruce Rehm, he actually was writing his master's thesis at the same time as the field work was going on. So we were research associates for the museum until probably about 86 or so. And then there was no more funding. We got one grant from the Forest Service to do a survey of Prince of Wales Island. So Bruce and myself and his daughter Carrie, who was only 4 at the time, went down and we surveyed the northern part of Prince of Wales Island, the little area, for the Forest Service. And then after that, there was no more money. So Bruce got a job in Anchorage with Hart Krauser doing, it was some kind of a big survey, and I'm sorry, I'm going to forget what it
was
for. Yeah, so we moved to Anchorage.
Okay.
And then I got a job with the Park Service in 1988. And I worked as a museum technician.
Oh, so you didn't do archaeology?
No, I was a museum technician, and I was actually, it was a good job because I was pregnant with our older son, Alan. So I didn't want to go out and do field work. So it was fun. I just sat there and I learned how to, you know, do the databases and learned about herbarium collections, and it was all good.
Okay. And then how did you get involved with this Skagway project?
So I was a seasonal with the Park Service for a long time, very long time. I started out as a museum technician, and then I stayed home after Alan was born. And then Jean Griffin, who was one of the archaeologists there, knowing that I did research and writing, asked me to write the report for the Cultural Resource Mining and Inventory and Monitoring Program, CRMIM. So that was a very big project also. And what that was... There were mining claims within the national parks, and there was an uproar about that. So crews had to go out there and actually survey and find the sites and evaluate them for the National Register. So I was not on those crews. They were doing it the summer that like Alan was born and the summer before, but. It was an incredible amount of data, lots and lots of data, file cabinets full, and they needed a big report. So Jean Griffin hired me to write the report. So I started doing that. It was on a seasonal basis, or maybe it was a term position. I'm not quite sure. So I did that. Actually, I did that for 11 years. It took me 11 years to do that report.
Wow.
Yeah, because there were over 350 sites in 9 parks.
Wow.
And it was not like... the entire, you know, scope of what the mining was about in the national parks in Alaska.
And so these are historic mining sites, not
yes.
currently active.
Some of them were, they were historic sites, yeah. Some of them might be peripherally still involved in mining. So I did that, and then I started doing other things for the Park Service. My background was in zooarchaeology, so I do little projects like that. And then... I finally did get hired to take Susan Morton's position to do archaeological education, and that was through the National Register Program. So I got involved in National Historic Landmarks. But specifically the Skagway Report, I'm telling you what I was really hired to do.
Right.
But what I ended up doing a lot of is when people would come and go, like they would have a summer internship, and they would have a project and it wouldn't get finished because they didn't have enough time or whatever the circumstances are, they'd give it to me. And they'd say, my boss was Ted Burkadahl, who was a wonderful boss. And he said, and also I had Gary Summers, who was also the senior archaeologist at the Alaska Regional Office for a while. So they would give me these reports that were half finished and say, here, finish them. And I really loved that because there was lots of stuff already there, but I was given the freedom to kind of change the path that the first researchers were going. You know, I could just say, well, this is all really good, but let's change this, and they'd say, sure, whatever you want to do. I was given freedom to do it. Mm-hmm. And I loved that.
And were who was the audience for these reports?
They were just Park Service reports, you know, just like the Skagway report.
Right.
It was just like an administrative report or one of the ones that I really enjoyed was doing the Elmendorf Homestead report. And I'm not sure where that money came from. I really can't remember, but the state was involved in doing the actual field work. And then somebody, there was like a graduate student who had to leave at the end of the summer, who started out the homestead report, but then she had to go back to go to school or whatever she did. And here was, again, all this data, like tons of data, and it needed to be made into a report. So that's how I got involved in the Skagway Report.
And by saying those reports are written for a public audience?
Yes, they're written for the public. You know, the Park Service reports are published for the public. They're published for other researchers, but they are for the public, and you can get them for free.
Right.
Yeah.
And then they also, in some cases, maybe Park Service employees is an audience as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's a diverse audience, but it's basically, you know, for the public.
Right. Because I was thinking, if you have all this data, you know, how do you decide what direction to present it in? As you said, sometimes you would change the direction from what the researcher had done.
Well, I think that you certainly have to think about your audience. You have to think about why there is money to do this in the first place, and you have to try to satisfy those various, you know, goals. Mm-hmm. So, that's what I did.
It sounds challenging.
I think that's why I liked it, because it was never easy. It was never easy, and I like that. I like to go to work and really, think about it and have the opportunity to be a little bit creative, but certainly draw into what I enjoy a lot is just doing the research and asking a question. I think when I look at the cover of the Skagway Report, I see some interesting artifacts, historic artifacts, and I remember having, and really I didn't see these artifacts. Most of the time I just had the pictures, and I'd think, I wonder, I see it right here. I see this blue and white ceramic plate.
Right.
Like, what about this? What do we know about this? And having really the freedom to spend a lot of time figuring it out.
Right.
And that was like, great. You go to work and you get to figure out this great puzzle. It's just a wonderful thing.
And I know most people don't necessarily associate the Park Service with the freedom to kind of run with something, because as a big bureaucracy, it's sometimes known for rules and regulations.
I had a great job. I had a great boss. I was given lots of freedom. I really was given so much freedom, I could sort of invent what I wanted to do. Not many people can say that,
right.
And I, you know, it's rare, and I appreciate that I had that opportunity.
Right. And this Skagway Report, 2011.
Uh-huh.
So when did you start?
I started it probably 5 years before. I'm not the very fast. It takes me a long time. It took me 5 years, and the person who started it, her name was Yvonne Meyer, and she was a graduate student, so she was working on her own thesis, and you know, she just didn't have the time to devote to it, so they let me run with this for a while, and I, you know, I was doing, my real job was landmarks, but Skagway is a landmark, so, you know,
yeah,
it all fit in.
Do you know whose idea it was to do this 30-year overview?
So the person whose idea it was, I am fairly sure, Sandy, her name now is Faulkner.
Oh, yeah, Anderson.
Her name was Sandy Faulkner Anderson McDermott.
Yeah.
So she changed through marriage and divorce, different names. But she was the senior historian, and she wanted to do some kind of administrative report on the archaeology. Yvonne was hired to do that, and like I said, she was a graduate student and was not able to really complete it because of her own research. So this was one of the things that was given to me. Here we spent all this money and there's no product. Why don't you do the product? And I'm thinking, oh boy. You know, I had 11 years of research experience working on mining sites, so I sort of had a background.
Right.
So it was, I was thrilled.
And you also were an archaeologist.
Yes.
So that helped, I'm sure. Because, I mean, I know that there'd been archaeology going on in Skagway.
A long time.
A long time, mm-hmm. And lots of reports. They had that series.
Yes, that were wonderful reports.
Right.
And, you know, let me just mention that this book, I dedicated this book to people who are really good Alaskan historic archaeologist and who actually worked in Skagway as field workers, and that was Carl and Doreen and Kathy.
So Carl Gerke, Doreen Cooper, and Kathy, now Spoody.
Yeah. And they were the ones who did the archaeology. I was the one who just went through all the files and got to look at the pictures and, you know, think about it. And it's actually a pretty book, and I will say we were talking earlier about Frank Broderick, and right. It's a pretty book because of him. He and I worked together. You know, I had some of the ideas, but certainly many of the ideas and how well it looks is all attributable to Frank.
Yeah, Frank does all the design and layout and production part. Well, the reason I was asking all those, that series of archaeological reports that Kathy Lee Spoody did, there were many of those write-ups. They're much more technical kind of documents than what you've done.
This is an overview of a whole bunch of things. And it's not only it's the archaeology, but it's the sort of the administration, which was not the fun part to write. That was the hard part to write, because it was file cabinet after file cabinet of, you know, a memorandum of agreements and, you know, all sorts of federal entities involved. And like, what does this mean, really? What can you say about one whole file drawer of this in kind of a summary that won't make people want to go to sleep? So that's what I had to do. But then I think that was the original intent of it. But I didn't want to just do that. That wasn't, you know, that was necessary, but not necessarily fun. So I went through all the reports and I tried to figure out, well, what does this mean? You know, what can we say? What kind of stories can we tell? I try to be a storyteller. It's real important to me. So I wanted to tell the story. So that's, I think, what I tried to work into it.
Well, and that's what I found in it. And as I say, it's much more readable and tells a story than just reading an archaeological report with diagrams and the stratigraphy. And if you're an archaeologist, I'm sure all those things make sense and you come out with an understanding. But as a member of the public, that stuff doesn't make sense. You don't come out with a story.
Right. And I wanted to tell a story. And I think what I really wanted to do as I was, like I said, I worked on it for 5 years. I had other work to do, but I did work on it for 5 years. There were people who were detractors of the archaeology of Skagway. Okay. And I'm going to, the researchers, professors who I know and are friends of mine, were friends of mine, I haven't seen them in a long time, but Oregon State, you know, they would look at it in an academic sense and that they wanted to get to the research. And I'm thinking, well, this is research. This is research. This is good research. Just because it's within the setting of a bureaucracy and what you have to do for, you know, to get the money to do it and to comply with 106 and all that doesn't mean it's not research. So I wanted to highlight it in the greater view of all this kind of just feeds in to the real research. And I think in one of the last chapters I mentioned the topics that were important research topics and how everything that was done really could be used to feed in to answering those questions. As I said, I worked for the National Historic Landmark Program, so landmarks are real important to me. And I know that there aren't that many mining national historic landmarks in the western United States. So one chapter is actually about landmarks on the western mining frontier. Yeah. And that part was really fun. And I went to visit some of these places just on my own vacations because I was interested. And to find out what other people were doing in other states in terms of their landmarks and the research. And I think I found out that Alaska was doing darn well in the programs that were bringing light to the historic archaeology in these landmarks.
So that was sort of putting Skagway's work in a larger context.
Yes.
I remember in the book you mentioned this thing that academic archaeologists sort of questioned the work in Skagway. Can you talk more about how they were critical of it?
Well, you know, there's always been that rift between the academic archaeologists and the government archaeologists, and they're working under different parameters of different frameworks. You know, academic archaeologists like to think that they're doing pure research, which maybe sometimes they're lucky enough to do, but certainly there's somebody paying the bills. Somebody's paying them. Somebody wants a final product. And the government archaeologists, of course, have to work under the auspices of the 106 process. And so they're kind of at odds, but certainly they all want to basically tell the story. What happened here? Why is this important? Why does somebody who lives in Bozeman, Montana, why do they want to know about it?
Right.
So there's always that conflict. What I was trying to say is there doesn't have to be that conflict. Maybe some people think there should be a conflict and there is maybe egos involved, but to me, it's all feeding in to the little details that we know about what happened in the past, and that's really what we're doing.
Yeah. Is some of the criticism about clearance archaeology, 106, that's a...
Section 106 of the Historic Preservation Act, uh-huh.
And that says if there's a project, it has to get archaeological clearance
right.
first?
So in other words, if there is a project and they're putting in, let's say, an outhouse, well, you can't just say, well, okay, here's this outhouse, but there's something really interesting over there. Perhaps if you have an NSF grant, you could say, oh yeah, let's go over and look at that too, because that feeds into the bigger story. If you have, if you're working on a specific 106 project, well, you can't do that. That's not part of it. We're doing this right here. This little square is it.
Right.
So that really puts restrictions on people, but I think that Carl and Doreen and Kathy did a fabulous job of doing what they had to for their government work and yet having a broader view of telling the story.
Well, and with clearance work, sometimes there's a time pressure. You know, like in Skagway, we've got this building we want to renovate. You guys have to look underneath it. And
yes.
If you find something, you're holding up the rest of the project.
Exactly. So there's all those pressures.
So does that affect the quality of the archaeology? I don't know. Quality might not be the right word.
Well, I think the quality of the archaeology they did was excellent. I think it kind of probably put a lot of stress on them.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't have to do any field work there, so I don't know. But I'm sure that the time pressures and certainly the fact that it's Alaska and you can't work year round. Right. Is another factor.
Well, you had mentioned looking through all these administrative files. That was one of my questions for this report. What were your resources?
Oh.
What did you...
Well, I worked at the regional office in Anchorage, and before the archaeology was, you know, sent out to the parks and they did their own archaeology, it was all done in the region. So we called them the gray elephants. We had these gray elephants. I'm sure they're still there. These huge files, everything you ever wanted to know about any project 10 times over was in these files. And, you know, people didn't have the time to go through all this stuff. They had to kind of move on. But so if I wanted to do anything about the actual administration, I had to go through all these files. I still remember that.
And what about for like the archaeology? Like you wanted to know about the Mascot Saloon project
or
something?
Well, there were all these reports that you were mentioning, the archaeological series, and I based, you know, that was much of what I did was based on those reports. So I would just kind of get a sense of what they had done and try to summarize it summarize it without as much detail as they provided in the original report.
So you didn't go back and look at all their original data or the original artifacts?
Only if I had to. I mean, if there was some question that I couldn't answer, then I did. I did go to Skagway a couple times to look at the artifacts and to photograph the artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
That was and to talk to Carl, and that was really wonderful and interesting. So I did a little bit of everything. Which makes it, you know, I think if you're not having a good time, it's not going to be a very good product. If you really enjoy it and it's like great, and you think, oh boy, I get to go to work today. Oh boy, I get to take a trip to Skagway and see Carl. You know, look at the artifacts, and then you really are into it. Then it's going to be a better product.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how archaeology does help tell the story and why that's important.
Okay, well, when you do historic archaeology, of course, you have the historic documents. And I think lots of times, you know, they give you an excellent background, which you don't have in prehistoric archaeology often, because there's not the written documents. You just have to tell the story on the basis of the artifacts. But in historic archaeology, you are able to ferret out the details that the written record doesn't tell you. I think probably one of the most interesting ones, I think the work that Kathy Spoody and Doreen Cooper did on the various, like, for example, the Father Turnell's trash pit and the fact that there were liquor bottles there. I thought that was a pretty interesting story. Now, when you read the historic records, you're not going to really see a picture of the man's life in that detail. You're going to maybe see his good works, but you're not going to see how he really lived. And don't we really want to know how people lived? Isn't that why we tell stories? Right. We want to know about that. So I think that is the benefit of it, is that you get to see these details and understand little quirks or little interesting things that people are curious, and they want to know that. And that's what makes it fun and interesting.
Yeah, but it is interesting that quite a number of the excavations in Skagway seem to have been in trash pits or privy pits.
That's where they threw things. That's where they threw them. I mean, if you just throw them on the street or you throw them in the garbage can, they're gone.
Right.
But if you throw them in a trash pit, in a privy, they're there.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that people threw things into privies.
Yes. And I didn't know really until I started this that they did. And that's where lots of the information came from.
Yeah, and is that typical for historic archaeology?
I think there's
a lot of privy excavation?
Yes, I think there is, yeah.
Which does not sound particularly glamorous.
Well, probably when you're doing it, it isn't. Yeah. I can't actually say that I've... No, that's not true. I was going to say I haven't ever done it. I have done it as in Seward, and it's really pretty interesting.
Really?
Yeah. All the gross stuff is usually gone.
Oh, that's
it's all decomposed. But you know, I did one in Seward on some kind of a park service. They were, I can't remember exactly what it was. It was a land exchange or something. But there was an old privy site in the alley right behind one of the main streets in Seward, and it was one of the earliest historic sites in Seward, mm-hmm. And it was a privy site. We found wonderful, interesting glass and all sorts of stuff. It was great.
Yeah. Well, and I guess, as you say, you didn't have in that time period in Skagway, there wasn't like a town dump where you would take things. Of course, you're going to throw it in a hole in the ground.
Right.
Nowadays, we don't think about it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it was interesting in one of them, the privy, they analyzed some of the decomposed layers and found seeds and things. And they could tell a little bit about what people might have been eating.
Right, exactly.
And I thought that was fascinating that you could tell that.
Uh-huh, yeah. So bones and seeds and they are great for about... Well, certainly it tells you about the environment if you're doing a prehistoric site, and also about, you know, the culture of what people were eating if you're doing a historic site.
Yeah. There was another one of the privies. Oh, I don't know. Maybe it was at the Moore House where there were all the medicine bottles.
Oh, yeah.
And...
Yes, that was one of Doreen's things.
And that that made people think, well, was Mrs. Moore, Minnie Moore...
Yeah.
Was she consuming that as alcohol, or was it actually medicine for the children, because that was a family home.
Right.
And
yes, and she was an interesting character, wasn't she?
Yeah, and that makes me ask the question about, you know, how do you know?
Well, I guess even in historic archaeology, you don't know for sure. I mean, a few things are definitive, but you have another way of looking at it.
Right.
You know, you can't, I mean, I can't answer that question, but, you know, you... Perhaps that was medicine for the children, and perhaps she was indulging. I don't know.
Yeah. And that's what I was wondering. Like, how can you tell? And I guess that's one you can't. But yeah. Father Turnell, where there were liquor bottles.
And that was his house. There was no doubt.
Right. maybe his guests were all drinking and he wasn't.
But. Well, it's possible. But, you know, it seems like, well, the obvious is that he was drinking, and there was nothing against that. Except, was it during Prohibition?
No, I think it was just before.
Okay, I can't remember the dates.
I can't remember, but I think the dating on the bottles...
It was just before, yeah.
Yeah. Which, again, that's a whole other interesting part, is how they figure out the dates...
Right.
Based on the glass and the...
Yeah.
The yes. color and the shape and...
Right. That's all stuff that I truly didn't know much about, and I don't think I still know much about, but, you know, certainly the people who did the original reports did. They went into that quite a bit, the dating of the glass and the beads and the porcelain, and it's all very interesting stuff.
Mm-hmm. And now, do you think that the interpretive rangers in Skagway use some of this information in their programs?
I hope they do. I hope they do, because, you know, people, that's, it is for the public, and people want to know this kind of stuff. They're people who go to the parks and go on those tours, they want to know that. They, you know, this is tax dollars for a good purpose. They think, okay, well, we're learning something here. We're enjoying ourselves. This is a national resource that we have, and we want to know about it. So I hope they do. I don't know specifically, but I hope they do.
Yeah, I mean, I think you say, as a visitor, you go into the Mascot Saloon, you want to know what happened there. Or you see those bottles in the window, it makes you go,
yeah.
Oh, what are those?
And they have hundreds of thousands of visitors.
Yeah.
And so it's a perfect audience who go there because they're interested. So, of course,
right.
they need to have stories. I mean, if you tell somebody, well, we did a 106 undertaking on that piece of ground over there, and people are going to just kind of move away and go to the tourist stores and... You know, but if you tell them a story, they're going to be captivated and they're going to want to know more.
Yeah, and those artifacts that get excavated can be used in an exhibit as well.
Right. True.
Yeah, and help tell those stories.
Yeah.
So, you mentioned Father Tunnell as sort of a favorite. Can you remember from the research for this book other sort of favorite tidbits of yours?
You know, when I have a copy right here, and I'm looking through the pictures, and I see these ceramics. I see Minnie Moore. She was a very interesting person because she was Native American. And,
yeah.
You know, the thing that I wanted to know about more were not the people who were in the historic documents as their names. They were important people in Skagway, but the people we didn't were unnamed.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to know why they were there and how they lived, and I wanted to know how they got some of these really nice looking pieces of ceramics and plates and cups into their houses. And I was just interested in the ordinary people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what made me the most interested. And I don't know if I think I did learn a little bit about them. I think that I realized that they were just ordinary people who were trying to live the best they could, and they did have some beautiful things. So, I mean, think about in the late 1800s and the effort it took to bring a beautiful piece of china to Skagway and have it survive and used. And, you know, I don't know. I just like those are the stories I like.
Yeah.
The people who are unnamed, and we can imagine how they lived, and maybe even kind of make up stories in our heads
yeah.
that might not be based on facts, but, you know, and the dolls, you know, the ceramic, the heads of dolls. So there were children there.
Right.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's all interesting to me. I mean, there's so many things you can just kind of go off on any kind of direction and think about the people and wonder.
Yeah, and I like your idea about the china, to think about, you know, traveling all the way from, you know, St. Louis
uh-huh.
to Skagway, and it was a long way, and you'd bring china?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And, or how that china got up there and could be purchased there. I guess also part of the Skagway story that this archaeology shows is it wasn't just the gold rush. You know, there was the gold rush, but some of this stuff is people who settled there
right.
and had a permanent
yes.
place.
Yes, and that's what was interesting to me. You're saying it right now. So the people who decided to stay, you
mm-hmm.
know, this was their home, and they were going to make the most of it, and they were going to have a nice house and some nice things, and live there as Americans and, you know, do their thing in a far-flung area that most people don't even know about.
Right. And, you know, people think Gold Rush, the Stampeders, they don't think about, well, there were families.
Yes.
And children.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know what the children would have done for school. They
did. I guess after they have a certain number of children in town, they do have to have a school.
Yeah. There was a school eventually. I just don't know when it started.
Yeah, I can't remember the specifics either. But yeah, that they have to start providing for the children. They have to set up the streets. They have to, you know, set up their government. And then this is all above and beyond the Gold Rush itself, because they're going to live here now.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of that happened after the Gold Rush.
Yes.
You know, there were a couple years of the Gold Rush, and then people started leaving, and then it kind of coalesced into more of a community.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I get from the book.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, that part's the interesting part to me.
Yeah. Something else I was going to say about... Well, that's always my question about archaeology in general is, okay, here you find this part of a ceramic dish, or whether it's a... You know, a prehistoric site with a point, mm-hmm. a stone point versus a ceramic dish, and the stories that kind of get told about the meaning of that,
mm-hmm.
and how much of that is fact versus how much is it storytelling.
Well, I mean, if you're writing an archaeological report, you have to base it all on fact. I'll tell you, the one thing I learned in writing a dissertation, it was prehistoric, it wasn't historic, but I remember I had to do 4 years of looking at bones and looking through archives and reading the journals of Lewis and Clark. I based the ethnohistory of what I did on the Columbia River a lot on their travels. You know, so I did this for a long time, and I was like, I was getting to the end of my dissertation, and it was all the facts were there. You know, how many bones, what did this mean, what animals, where were the villages? And then I got to like the second to last page, and it was like, wow, now I get to be creative. I presented everything, and now, I mean, I'm not going to tell you 100% sure this is what happened, but I can kind of go off on a little riff here, and I can imagine. And that was... I still remember that feeling of, yeah, after 4 years of doing this, I deserve to write one page of speculation. So, you know, you frame it as such. This is what I learned, and this I can't say for sure, but this is what I think happened. Mm-hmm. So that was really fun for me. I still remember that day writing that, and I don't know whether that was true, but, you know, certainly there was truth in it.
Well, and in this book, you do at the end have a chapter about how this material can be used or some ideas for further research.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know whether any of that further research ideas were followed up on?
Honestly, I don't. Honestly, I don't. Because this was one of my last projects before I retired. So I finished this book and I had another maybe couple of months or something. And then I retired. So... I truly admire the people who carry on interest into retirement and continue to do, their past research and have a lifelong interest. I'm not one of those people. So when I retired, I felt that I had done all my jobs and that I had closed every chapter I needed to, and I just did something else. So I don't know. I did not follow up. It was great while it lasted, and I figured now somebody else can do it, but it's mm-hmm. not my job anymore, so I'm moving on.
Were there any projects you wish you could have done?
Oh, man, this is a good question. God, there's so many projects. I mean, everything is interesting. I'm trying to think if there was anything else. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, because I really tried to finish up everything. And when I retired, I moved on and started doing other things that were not anthropology and not archaeology that I was interested in. One of the things I like to write novels, so mm-hmm. I've done that in retirement. But what is kind of interesting is archaeology also always filters into it. Mm-hmm. And anthropology also filters into it, because that's who I am and I can't get away from it.
Right. But so you felt like all your Park Service projects, you finished all those reports?
I did. I felt like I finished them. I wouldn't have retired unless I could have said that.
But there was a particular Alaska subject that you wished you could have done a project on that never got funded or...
Well, I started off in archaeology, as I mentioned, with the bones. And there are lots of zooarchaeological collections out there that... I mean, it's a tedious thing. I mean, the only people who have a more tedious job are the people who do the seeds.
Yeah.
I mean, that's more tedious. And the pollen, yeah, that's even more tedious. But bones are pretty tedious.
Yeah.
But I like them a whole lot. And, you know, I would be happy to sit in a table with nobody else in the room and just do bones. So, you know, any zooarchaeological project that would surface would be interesting for me.
Yeah. I'm just looking at the book to see if there was some other questions about, you know, part of the question was, how you did this and how you put it together and how you decide what goes in and...
Oh, okay, so I can
kind
tell
of
you...
A process methodology.
Yeah, so I based the look of this book, which of course could not have been done without Frank Broderick, because he's the brains of formatting and design. He is the brains. But there is a book that I used, it was a historic archaeology of Albany, New York, and it was beautifully set up, and I used it as the model. So I had a model to go by, so I used whatever I was, the research that I was putting together for Skagway, and I used the model of that book, and Frank loved the book. If Frank didn't love the book, the other book, we couldn't have done it, but he loved it. He said, yeah, you're right. So between Frank and I, we figured it out.
I remembered the question I was going to ask from when I was reading this book, that there's quite a bit of mention that, okay, one person did work on this site and came up with an analysis this way and how they grouped artifacts or how they put meaning to it all. And then another archaeologist comes along and does it in a different way for a different site. So... How do you compare? It seems like methods change or interpretations change.
Yes.
So how does that all get combined to create a meaning? It seems like you're mixing apples and oranges.
No, that's a very good question. Certainly everybody has their own methods. I think you have to always go back to what the original method was, understand what they did, and then, you know... Of course, you can't just do the same thing over and over. People, you know, in any kind of science, and it is a science, you discover that, okay, well, this is what they originally did, but we can improve on this. So it's a matter of refining your methods, and that's good, you know. So it's not necessarily apples and oranges. It's just making a better orange.
Mm-hmm.
It's just looking at it a little bit differently, but always... You know, going back to the original and saying, okay, this is what they had to work with then. They only had a small sample. And now 10 years later, we have a much larger sample. We can look at it a little bit differently. It doesn't negate what they did originally.
Because sometimes it seems like it was a lumping versus a splitting.
Yeah, and that's a sort of a philosophical thing that I guess whatever researcher has to deal with, whether you're a lump or a splitter.
But you as the compiler of this... summary, how do you put those together?
I think in every case you have to put it together the best way you can. I mean, you know, you have to say, okay, acknowledge that one researcher looked at it this way, one researcher looked at it that way, and maybe the third, who hasn't come along yet, will look at it a different way. You know, there are different ways to look at it. Acknowledge those. And like I said, if you have the opportunity to speculate and say, okay, well... could be this, it could be this, you know. I personally believe A, or I personally believe B. You know, just as long as it's clear. It has to be clear. It's like you can't just make things up. I think that's why I like to go on to fiction, because after I retired, because to me there were so many other interesting things to say, good stories, that I didn't want to be restrained by simply the facts. I wanted to be able to go off and do more creative things. In an archaeological report, you can't do that.
Right.
As long as you can present the evidence and then you speculate as to what is the most logical.
Right.
Did that I answer your question?
Yeah, well, I was going to say that how you as the compiler took these different archaeological perspectives and were able to put them next to each other.
Uh-huh.
That seems like a lot of research and hard work on your part. You had to understand all of the methods.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, and some of them I went into not understanding, so I had to learn. I mean, of course, as a researcher, that's what you want to do. You want to learn. You're curious. You want to learn. Lots of these methods that they used, the field workers, you know, Carl and Doreen and Kathy, I was not familiar with them, so I had to learn them. I had to learn what they did, and I had to ask other people, and that's all good. That's all part of the process, and you have to. If you don't know what they did, then you really can't write about it.
Right. That's kind of what I was getting at. Like, and how did you learn that?
I know enough about archaeology that I can read the books. I don't even know how many. There's probably a pretty big bibliography.
Yeah.
But, you know, I had to read them. I had to call people. Lots of good historic archaeology was done in Fairbanks. At the Northern Land Use did a lot of stuff on Barnett Street, which mm-hmm. I brought into this. I talked to those researchers. So I talked to those archaeologists. I mean, we're all friends. I mean, it's a pretty small circle of people, so I was able to see how they did their research and try to incorporate it to better understand Skagway.
And was this your first foray into historical archaeology?
No, I had spent 11 years doing the...
Oh, the mining.
Yeah, the mining report.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
But in terms of in terms of field work, I only did really prehistoric archaeology in my own field work.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't get to do any of the field work in Skagway?
No, I didn't do any field work in Skagway.
But you researched the collections, I guess, you said?
Yes. Yeah, I went there, I looked at the collections. People in the curatorial department there in Skagway helped me. I mean, I had them pull out the artifacts I wanted to look at and photograph.
Mm-hmm. So how did you know which artifacts you wanted to look at?
I'd read all the reports. I mean, I had to read all the reports. I had to see what was typical, what was unique, and get a little bit of each one of those and kind of look at the whole range. You know, they had nails. Nails might not be all that fascinating, but, you know, they can tell you interesting things about the time period and how things were built. You know, and they had ceramics, they had glass, they had beads, they had, you know, so they had I had to have a little bit of all of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I thought it was interesting about the nails, the shape of the nail,
mm-hmm.
the wire nails versus the square nails, and somebody researched the history.
Yeah, well, Kathy Spooty did a lot of that. I'm sure Carl did, too.
Yeah, to know how that
yeah.
came about, and then I think it was the porcelain or the ceramics, you know, some came from England, and some, then the U.S. started.
Yeah.
You know, all of that is, you know, you say it tells this bigger story.
Yes, and I think that's it. It's the bigger story. Once you get into a little part of, little tiny tunnel vision on one place, you sort of have to put it into a bigger perspective, or what does it all mean? And you can see how everything sort of fits together.
Mm-hmm.
I like that.
Yeah. And then the one of the sites where they were building the maintenance building,
mm-hmm.
wasn't that more of a World War II
yeah.
site?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and Doreen was doing those, and
right.
You know, talking about the military presence, and, you know, what you can tell about the guys who were there.
Yeah, yeah,
that's all interesting too.
Yeah, so that the story of Skagway is more than just the gold rush.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think the military one, it was a lot of beer bottles, I think.
If I remember, yeah.
If I remember correctly.
Yeah, you read the book more recently than I did, so I'm going to forget.
But that's also, I mean, that's what I remember, but also I think that's what I would expect.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You know, and the saloon, the mascot, and the pantheon, you know, it was more, I found it interesting. It got separated into men's kind of sites and
uh-huh.
family sites, and based on the type of artifacts
right.
that were found.
Yes, yes. I mean, that's common to all archaeology. Frequently, you don't have enough data to certainly prehistoric sites to do that, but sometimes you do.
Yeah, well, you know, prehistoric sites, you could see, well, this was the the hearth and the kitchen area, or this was the butchering area.
Right.
Or something like
but
that.
But as far as, you know, coming down to who exactly, was it a man or a woman or was it a child, you don't often get that opportunity because it's just not that well preserved.
Right. Well, in the saloons and the Skagway sites, the assumption is that those were mostly male facilities.
Right.
But women may have gone in there, you know, certainly the prostitutes at the time may have been in those saloons.
Yeah, and I think Kathy Spruity does a good job of pointing out the different gender-related artifacts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Were any of the cribs ever excavated or cleared?
I think they were, but I don't really, I can't remember the details, so I can't really answer too much about that.
And part of the problem, Skagway, is buildings got moved a lot.
Yeah, they did.
I don't know how that affects the historic archaeology.
Well, certainly you have to know the building history if you're gonna excavate. You really have to know the building history before you start, and maybe you'll find out things that are inconsistent with the historic documents, and then you have to, what really happened? Yeah, if it was all just if you're not learning anything more than just what you get from the historic documents, then you're not doing much good, because you're okay, well, this is it. But if you're learning a little bit more and you know, improving, refining what we know, then that's when it becomes valuable.
And it seems like for your book you had to do a lot of the historic research yourself before you could start writing and putting it together. You had to become knowledgeable on Skagway's history in general. Which sounds like an overwhelming project in and of itself.
Well, if you like to do it, it's not overwhelming, you know. I mean, it just depends on what you like to do. I mean, I like to look at little tiny bones, and I like to look at little details of history. To me, that's fun.
Yeah.
So I like to do it.
Right.
You know, everybody has their own forte.
Well, you said that originally you were hired to do archaeological education.
Yes, that's what my main thing was.
And so can you describe what that means?
Okay. That means just bringing archaeology to the public. Frequently it has to do with school children. And the reason I got involved in that is, before I started, the person who actually started that work was Susan Morton, and she did. She started Archaeology Month. I think every state has an Archaeology Week or an Archaeology. We started as a week, and I remember we made it into a month, because how can you get everybody, all the archaeologists in Alaska, to do their programs in 1 week? You can't. You just say April. April is Archaeology Month. And then you just develop programs for the school kids, mostly for the school kids, but often for adults. You know, tell them, like, if you have a report like this, you tell them about Skagway. So it's just bringing the money, taxpayers' money, in the terms of our salaries and everything, out to the people to let them know what's going on. And it's certainly alive and well. I have a funny story about moving to Montana, which my husband and I moved here just about a month and a half ago, and I thought I had finished that stuff. I'm not doing this anymore. So I go to the museum, which is just down the street, at the Museum of the Rockies at MSU campus, and I'm going to look at the museum. I'd seen it before, but they were having Archaeology Month programs for the kids, and I backed out. I said, no, I don't want to know. I'm leaving. I've done this. I've done this for 25 years or more. I don't want to see this. And then I actually have a friend who I reconnected with, and she's still involved in it. And she still has programs that are going on in Montana, so she just contacted me, and now I'm going to be involved in that again.
All right.
So it's just, you know, it's just taking it to the public, and it's relevant, even if the children don't ever do any archaeology, because they learn things that are important for other anything. You know, they learn about measuring, they learn about numbers, they learn about history, they learn about the past of their state. So all this, you know, you put it in the guise of archaeology, but it has to do with education in general.
Well, it's doing sort of what this book was intended to do, is it's helping to show people what you can learn about the past from these artifacts that they dug up out of the ground.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
That you learn about the previous lifestyle.
Right.
And for people like us, that's really cool.
Yes.
And hopefully you can excite kids about it.
Right. And some are excited, and some just think it's another boring job. And I remember all the programs that I did, and if you really want to be humble, you work with kids, and sometimes they're real excited, and I often went to my own son's classes and gave any time they wanted a program, I would do it. Not only could I do it because I wanted to for my sons and their classmates' sake, but because I could do it on my job.
Right.
Oh, this is my work, I'll be glad to come. And I give them so many programs, and I remember my older son came home one day, and I said, well, what did you think? He says, yeah, another archaeology program. He said, you know, one of my classmates even came up and said, you know, Alan, your mother really has a boring job. And I thought, oh, God, oh, well. You can't please them all.
That's right. So when we said this beneath the surface, that was Sandy's idea. Do you know how the funding...
No, I do not.
Five years of funding, that's a lot of money.
The funding was to start Yvonne on the process.
Right.
I mean, I had a permanent job, and I did all my other job besides doing this. I mean, this became, you know, a big part of it, but I just had my salary.
Okay.
So the funding was basically just my salary.
Yeah, so it wasn't funded as a special project.
It started like that. So when they allocate the funds, you know, for the different projects at I can't remember even the name of
it. PMIS? Is
that yeah, it? There was that, and then there was the cultural resource, you know, people from all the parks, they divvy up the mm-hmm. money. However it got started was long in the past, and that money had been spent, and they were saying, well, what's the product? You know, mm-hmm. if we're going to spend this money, we want to see something. So that's how I became involved. And then after that, the money was gone, but I had a job and I had my salary, so I just worked on it.
Right. Well, I was just looking at the book. You do make suggestions about topics that could be followed up on or made into, you know, park handouts or whatever
yeah.
you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
So the residential privies, Father Tunnell's trash pit, and attitudes about drinking. Well, you say attitudes about drinking during the Prohibition era,
right.
So maybe he was right on the cusp there.
Yes, uh-huh.
Revelations about the early life in Skagway, Moore family privy, archaeological evidence of the U.S. Army in Skagway, what people drank at Gold Rush era saloons.
Hmm. Yeah. Were they like kind of highbrow people? I doubt it.
Well, and that I'm guessing would be that the types of bottles,
yeah,
would tell you what types of alcohol.
Uh huh. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think people like to know those kind of things.
Yeah. Do you really save all those old bones, or what fauna remains can tell us about the eating habits in Skagway's past, and what broken dishes really tell us about the people who once lived in Skagway?
Yeah, the ordinary people. What I'm interested in. The ordinary people and how they live their lives. I think that's the way that archaeology has gone in the more recent decades. Because, you know, let's just take Egypt for example, which I really know nothing about. But I know certainly that they were more interested in the dynasties and that, you know, the kings and all that. And then they find out, well, what about all these people who built the pyramids? How did they live?
Right.
And then that becomes interesting to people.
Mm-hmm. There's some other things here about, I guess this is for interpretive staff, things to start a dialogue, I guess, with their audiences about what is archaeology, what are archaeological resources, what do archaeologists do, how do archaeologists figure out how old things are, what are our personal and professional responsibilities, areas of sensitivity, and then highlighting archaeology in Skagway. So this is a good one about personal and professional responsibilities. Can you talk about archaeological stewardship and ethics in archaeology?
Well, if you work for the government, you know, you realize that there are lots of laws and regulations that pertain to archaeological sites, and aren't we lucky in this country that we have them? Otherwise, we would lose a lot of information. Certainly, many of us, most of us maybe, who have jobs with the government. We made a livelihood, a way of living, on the basis of the farsightedness of our, you know, people who make our laws in Washington, D.C., so I appreciate that. You know, you might, sometimes it's just a matter of doing it because it's the law and you're not going to gain anything from it, but I think many times you do. You learn something new and you can share it with somebody, so that's your responsibility. And those are the ethics of what you have to do as an archaeologist. You know, you have to, you do this for the purpose that it was intended, to gather the information, give the information back to the public, whatever you gather, collections are in the museum, properly stored, so future people can go and look at them and make further interpretations. So that's part of the whole cycle. And I think we're lucky in this country that we have those laws and regulations, because it enriches all of our lives.
Mm-hmm. And what about, you know, sort of the protection of archaeological sites? Now, in Skagway, a lot of the sites are under buildings now or things, but so I don't know how protection of archaeological sites applies to Skagway.
Well, you know, there's a public-private thing. If it's on public land, it must be protected. That's the law. If it's on private land, the law does not pertain. So, you know, you would hope that the people are generous enough and that they would want to share the information, not hoard it for themselves or keep it to themselves. Or maybe they just don't want anybody to know about it because it's going to affect how they deal with their own private property. So I think even if you work for the government, you have to reach out to these private people and say, look, you might have something very valuable there. I think most people recognize that and are willing to share.
Well, and in Skagway, yes, all this excavation has been done on Park Service buildings or properties for the most part. There's a lot of private property in the historic district, mm-hmm. or in the town in general, and they don't necessarily get excavated.
Right, but they do get the help of the Park Service. And I worked with the Steve Peterson and Grant Crosby did lots of the architecture there, historic architecture, and they work with the private people to make sure that their buildings are not, you know, that are historically accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So those people get lots of government expertise just on the basis of that they're right there and that they want to make sure that it's not discordant with the rest of the landscape.
Right. And that's for the building itself, but for any of the underneath or
surroundings, they don't have to do anything. No. Well, unless they're getting federal money. If they're getting federal money because they're renovating and they're getting some kind of grant, yes, then they do have to. So it has to do with where the money is coming from. If they're just doing it on their property and not getting any federal money, it's not affecting the fabric of their building. I really can't see any of those situations really happening. Yeah, then if they're getting federal money, then they do have to comply with the law.
Okay. And all of this we've been talking about, the historical archaeology in sort of downtown Skagway, mm-hmm. around the buildings and things. Did you do any looking at the archaeology out in Dyea or along the trail?
Well, I actually looked at it one day. And I when you said that, I'm smiling. If you can't see me, I am smiling because I took my younger son with me, and he was probably about, I don't know how old he was. He was young, maybe 14 or something. And Carl Gerke took, my son's name is Galen Rehm. So Galen and I went to Skagway, and Carl took us on the tour of everything, including mm-hmm. Dyea. And, you know, he was so interesting. I know kids from having kids, but also from giving programs to kids. A 14-year-old is not that easy to impress. You know, if ever you want to really bore somebody, find a 14-year-old, and I assure you, you'll bore them.
Right.
Galen was not bored. Galen was very entertained by Carl, and he was very interested. And he showed us all around Dyea, and he gave us a wonderful tour. So I tried to bring in a little bit of that, you know, about the the cemeteries and things like that. So that's in there too.
Yeah, because there has been archaeology done.
Yes, interesting stuff.
And along the trail as well.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't know if they've done archaeology, but they certainly have collected and documented what's out there.
Uh-huh.
But I don't remember that from the book.
it's probably just mentioned in passing, because this was about the... just Skagway specific,
okay.
But you can't really talk about Skagway without talking about Dyean.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I think I probably mentioned it, but it was not focused on.
Flipped through that, I did see there was a sidebar on Dyean, but I see that's why the trail stuff, it was specifically intended just for
Skagway, yes.
The historic district of Skagway, okay. So you have to do another one about the trail.
Oh, other people have done that. Yeah, other people have done that.
As I say, this seems like an immense undertaking to have put all this information. Because what, that archaeological series is like 11 volumes?
I can't remember exactly. Maybe even more than that.
Yeah, I can't remember.
But yeah, it's a lot of... So I felt at the end, I'll tell you, I felt very proud to be part of that series and have a publication in it. Because, you know, that is years and years, 30 years of work. And yet... here it is for people to look at.
Right.
And I think if you look at... So I think one of the things that I did is I looked at all the other landmarks. And I think in Alaska we did a darn good job.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to other places in the country that might have done historic archaeology. I was looking specifically at landmarks. I had to narrow it down, otherwise I could have been studying it for the rest of my life.
Right.
But, you know, in terms of really looking at the landmarks, which are supposedly our most important sites, and they're not all historic. We have lots of prehistoric landmarks. But these were just the mining.
Right, these were just the mine. Well, because that's what matches with Skagway as a sort of mining history.
Right. Uh-huh. So, and I think I was proud of the Park Service for doing this. You know, in terms of... it was a landmark, it was Park Service land, and in other states, it's not necessarily the landmarks. Could be on private land, and you don't need to do all the stuff that was done in Skagway, but in Alaska, it was done. So I thought, yes, good job.
Well, and as you say, it is impressive that the Park Service funded 30 years of archaeology in one place.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That, to me, that shows they thought it was important.
Uh-huh. Yes, absolutely.
And... you must have thought it was important, too, after all of this.
Yeah. I mean, I was glad that... I mean, I was very happy to have had the opportunity to take up the research that would have sort of died there in our office and be able to do something with it and have a good time and maybe share it with somebody else.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, that 30 years, all those archaeological reports and the files of data might have just sat there.
Right. Nobody else wanted to go through those gray elephants. No.
Well, and, you know, not being an archaeologist and trying to read archaeological reports, I can tell you they don't hold my attention.
Yeah.
In the same
yes.
way.
Nails are not really, you know, overly exciting. But, you know, if you learn enough that you can get to the essence of it and portray it in a simple, straightforward way, it can be give you a little bit of information and it can be interesting.
Right, and I think that's what your book does, is it sort of serves as a translation.
Yeah.
And makes it more readable for the public. I do like that you called it Beneath the Surface, and you have a chapter, Stories Beneath the Surface.
Oh, I do? Oh.
Chapter 8, Archaeologists and Storytellers. We're cheating. Oh, we're looking at the book.
Yeah, okay. Well,
neither of us are going to remember.
I don't remember that, but good.
But I think that, I mean, just the title called Beneath the Surface, which... as you say, how objects can tell us about the past is interesting.
Mm. Well, thank you.
I think.
Thank you.
And I think that's important that people... here you say, these stories are not revealed by artifacts in isolation, but by artifacts found and carefully recorded in features such as trash dumps, privies, providing not only a time capsule of that time period, but also the preferences and even economic status of the individuals associated with them. I was going to ask you a question about, this is just archaeological terminology, about assemblages versus features.
So assemblage is the collection of artifacts, and it can be everything, or it can be a sub-assemblage, like the zooarchaeological assemblage. It can be, you know, the assemblage of the ceramics. You know, assemblage is just all the stuff. A feature is actually something on the ground that you can just destroy it with one shovelful, and it's gone. It's in the ground. You have to record it because you destroy it. So a feature could be something like a fire pit. It could be something like, I mean, features can be on the surface and they can go for miles and miles. Like in northern Alaska, like the lines of caribou drive lines. Mm-hmm. That can be a huge feature. Or it can be a little fire pit. Or it can be a post hole. But it's something that you can't dig up. And I mean, you could dig up maybe the wood there, but it doesn't mean anything. You have to record it on the ground.
Okay. And so, like in historic archaeology, the privy is not the feature. The privy is the whole site?
The privy can be the site or the feature.
Okay.
You know, so I mean, the site could be only a privy, and it would be one feature. Or you could have a site that had lots of features. It had a privy, it had a fire pit, it had a post hole that used to be, you know, an old part of an old structure, you know.
Or the sewer line, or
yeah.
More recent mm-hmm. layers. Because it's assemblage, features, and what's the other thing where there's...
Components,
or it's the lumping versus the splitting.
So one thing that's really, I find extremely interesting about archaeology is, of course, you're going down through the layers, and you are, many sites are occupied by different people at different mm-hmm. time periods because it's just a good spot, you know. It was good then, and it was good later, and it was good even later, and it's good now. So you go down and down and down. All right, you see the different layers of the earth, and you see the different types of artifacts. But it's not always that easy to figure out how to divide this up. There might be this gray area, and this you don't know, is it part of this occupation, you know, time period, or this occupation. So I guess that was the component. You know, it can have many different components and things. They were maybe all related to mining, or maybe it was the prehistoric people, and then they were the miners, and then they were the World War II guys. So you have to figure out how to use the data in the best way in order to portray what went on. And I learned that by doing the bones, because you know, if you have a very deep site and you can see 10 different strata, okay, well, here we have 10 different layers. Or maybe we only have 5 different layers, because maybe a couple of them merged. So what I'm trying to say is how you look at the data, how you divide up what you're looking at is extremely important, because you're going to tell a different story depending on how you do that. And that's what really makes it a science. You know, you have to take into consideration the stratigraphy. You have to take into consideration the artifacts, the carbon-14 data, maybe even other environmental factors. But you have to look at everything and say, okay, this makes sense. Here is one component, and then there is a gap, and here's another one, or maybe there's no gap. Maybe they just kind of merge into the other. So how do you analyze that? I like that. I like the way you can juggle, not juggle in a bad way, but I mean, look at the data in different ways, but you have to make sure it's as accurate as you can in order to tell the story correctly.
Well, and that was my previous question on some of these projects in Skagway. Somebody looked at the data one way, and then somebody else looked at it
yeah.
a different way. How do you put that all together to tell the story?
Yeah, well, I think, like I said before, you have to acknowledge what everybody did, and
right.
then, you know, maybe clearly somebody didn't do it correctly, but I don't think it was ever intentional. I think probably in the beginning, when you don't have much data, you just have to go with what you have.
Right.
And then as you learn more and more and more, of course, you're going to refine that, and you're going to be able to do the analysis better.
Right. I was trying to see if I could find an example of one of those. You know, sometimes it was, you know, a graduate student worked on something and...
That would be really tough. I mean, I think it would, to go into an area and not know anything about it and try to make sense of it, it's really tough. So the people who worked on it most consistently are the ones who really, you know, you'd have to take their interpretations more seriously than somebody who was there for just a brief period.
Yeah, I'm trying to look for the wording that I'm thinking of, and I can't think of, you know, assemblages, features, and the lumping, splitting, and there were certain...
Did I have a whole one of those gray sidebar things on that?
I don't know.
Yeah, I think I did. I liked that.
There is one here.
I liked writing that one. That was really interesting.
There's one, archaeological methods, researching, testing, analyzing, and reporting.
Yeah.
That's page 62.
Oh, I liked doing that one.
I'm not sure if that's the one I'm thinking of.
Yeah, I really like that. It spells out exactly what I was trying to say. Yeah.
This talks about measuring, shovel testing, trenching, the layers, cataloging. That's not the one I was thinking of. It was
so you have, you, yeah, I mean, you know, it's all very methodical, and that's why it takes so long. You can't just plow through it and jump to conclusions. You really have to do the analysis, and that takes a long time.
Yeah, I can't remember where it is. It was somewhere... that, you know, you're talking about this person looked at the artifacts by grouping them this way, and then somebody else grouped them that. I can't find the right terminology.
Well, you're maybe typology. Maybe, are you thinking typology?
Maybe.
Yeah.
About, like, maybe the glassware?
Yeah. So you certainly, I mean, that is prevalent throughout all archaeology. I mean, you can take an assemblage, that's a good word, an assemblage of stone points, for example. And depending on who you are or what method you're using, you're going to classify them and put them in different typologies. Well, it's the same with historic archaeology and with glass and with anything else. Do you look at the, you know, for example, the thickness of the glass? Do you look at the color of the glass? What's the most important aspect, characteristic of that artifact that you're using? Are you trying to date it? Are you trying to... say exactly who the manufacturer was. So the way you do the typology is what kind of... You always have to start with a question. You know, you start with a question. So here we have a whole assemblage of glass. What can I learn from this assemblage? Maybe all I can learn is when it came, you know, the dating it. That maybe that's all you can learn. So if that's all you can learn, then you have to devise your typology or classification on something that's going to help you date it. So you start with that question in mind. Maybe there are a couple questions, and then you can be more refined about your analysis.
Like you find all these glasses, you want to know what type of alcohol was in
them. Yeah, like Kathy Spoody wanted to do. So then you're going to look at other things. So if you have a piece that has a little bit of, you know, embossing on it, you know, that's going to be really cool. Whereas this is just a piece of the side that has nothing to do with the dating or... the manufacturer, well, that's not as important. So you can put it in an other category.
Well, I was thinking, if you want to know what kind of alcohol was in that bottle, you have to know what types of bottles were used for different alcohols, and maybe the color made a difference.
Oh, yeah, the color.
So that would be your driving question.
Yeah.
Or maybe you learn that the shapes of the bottles.
Yeah. So maybe you'd want to look at the shoulder, because that tells you, or the seam, that tells you when it was made, or maybe the lip of the bottle. So depending on what you want to know is how you're going to classify it.
But how do you know what you want to know?
Well, I mean, you go into anything with a question in mind. There's always a question, even if it's just a simple 106, you know, compliance thing. Here's a that we're building... in Denali, let's say, moving an outhouse, we know about the sites that are there or in the vicinity. What can we possibly learn? This is what I learned in graduate school. There's a few things that made a real big impression on me. And what it is, like, sometimes you're going to have a lot of sites and they're going to tell you the same thing over and over and over. Okay, well, that's fine, and maybe you don't need all those sites to tell you the same things over and over and over. But maybe there's another question that can that can lead you into a little bit more information. And when you go dig that modern outhouse site, that one is going to be in this kind of landform that we've not studied before. This is kind of like a low marshy area, and we don't know anything about the archaeology there, or maybe we don't know who was actually here. You know, so you always have a question. There's never a time when you don't have a question.
Well, and I can see what you mean. You have lots of sites that are the same, and Skagway could qualify in this way. You know, you have lots of places under buildings, but a new question of, let's look at what the women might have done. We don't know that.
Yes.
Or the children, or, oh, look, we're finding coins.
Yeah.
What does that tell us about the gambling?
Right, exactly. So I don't think there's never a time when you don't have a question.
There's always new perspectives to look at.
And the questions change through time. When you first go into an area, and it's, you know, you just have to say, well, when did people live here? When did they first start living here? Why were they here? And then you can get better and better questions as time goes on and you do more research. So after 30 years, you can ask some good questions.
Yeah, and I think Skagway is an example of, you know, they started with the Gold Rush questions, and eventually they moved to World War II questions.
Right. Because
there's this history of occupation, and they've continued to move through time with those questions.
Uh-huh.
I found one of the places I was thinking about is page 84, about the Pantheon complex. And in the analysis of the artifact assemblage from the Pantheon complex, specimens were classified, aggregated, and quantified somewhat differently than described previously.
That's the word aggregated. I love
that. Classifying and aggregating.
Yes, aggregating. That's the word I didn't use. Aggregating is important. Aggregating, you have to aggregate the data correctly. I mean, to the best of your ability. You just have to look at that data. How do you aggregate it? That's the lumping and the splitting. Do I look at this as 10 different entities, or do I look at this as only 3 different entities, both horizontally and vertically? You know, and if you look at it as 10 different entities, you're going to get a whole different picture as opposed to 3.
Right.
Maybe you have the whole saloon floor, and this is where the tables and the people were sitting, and this is the bar, and this is the doorway. Okay? Maybe there's only 3 different aggregates. Maybe you only want to look at it as 1 different aggregate. But if you look at it as 10 different aggregates, you're gonna find things that might not even be, there might be insignificant.
Yeah, and here you go on to see that Kardatsky, 2002, considered each feature to be the unit of aggregation, and then determined both the number of individual specimens and the minimum number of individual specimens for each type of artifact within each class, to arrive at a grand total of 8,739 artifacts. So this is where, you know,
the aggregation becomes important.
And that it's different from before. He did it, or she, I think Kardatsky's a he.
Yeah.
Did it differently than other people, and then that gets complicated in how you compare across projects.
Yeah.
So can you explain more about, well, you just did the unit of aggregation, but then the number of individual specimens, and each classifying types of artifacts versus specimens. It's a lot of archaeological terminology, but you're the archaeological educator, so you can explain it to me.
So if you have a bottle, okay, here's a bottle. I'm just looking at page 84.
Right.
Okay, that's a whole bottle. Okay,
right.
One unit. What if that bottle were broken up into 100 different pieces? You wouldn't necessarily know that that was one bottle. You might consider it 100 different bottles. Or, you know, you probably wouldn't. You'd probably say, well, this is maybe more than one bottle. So when you have an assemblage of things, the thing about archaeology is almost nothing is complete. Everything is broken, and you just get a fragment of it. So that's what the aggregation is. This is how do you put it together to get something meaningful. It's what is significant and what is meaningful. 100 pieces of green glass Well, that could be, I mean, what does that mean? Were there 100 bottles? Were 100 people drinking these things? Or was it just one bottle that got smashed?
How do you decide, each? Let's say it's broken into 100 pieces. Are each of those 100 pieces an individual item that gets numbered and cataloged?
They do get cataloged individually, or they could be cataloged as a lot.
Uh-huh.
Lots of things are cataloged as a lot, which means that it's something that was broken up, maybe one something or two somethings that was shattered, broken, and we can't really learn much except as looking at it as a whole. So, I mean, I guess that's where the science comes in. You know, you have to think about how did it get there? How did it get into the ground? Not only who put it there and how was it used, but how did it get in the ground? What's the process of making it an archaeological site? And not every tiny little piece of glass is going to be highly significant. So that's the job of the archaeologist, to decide what is important and what is not. How do you aggregate it? How do you look at it? How do you interpret it? And it's not like you can't read, you know, you can read about how to do it, but then you really have to sit there and think about it. Right. I mean, I often think about people who do archaeology in the field. Sometimes I think of them sitting there and just staring at the site and thinking of all these things. People lived here, people were here, people used these things, and then they left. And then the processes began to work. And then the ground began to frost heave. You know, all these things. So then all those things have to come into your interpretation.
Well, and in this case, you say that Kordatsky considered each feature to be the unit of aggregation.
Uh-huh.
So is that your example where the table was here, the bar
it
was
could
there?
Could be, yeah.
For discussion purposes,
right.
That would be an example.
Yes.
Each of table, bar, door,
right,
would be three different features.
Right. And maybe they should be, and maybe they shouldn't be. And maybe there were like two people there.
Right.
And they were just right there. And everything that was, everything you see in the ground was the result of these two people in 1 hour of time, and that's all their stuff. So are you really making a better interpretation by dividing it up into three features? Or maybe you should just say, this is just the bar room. This is
the whole saloon is the feature.
Yeah.
Well, and then you talk about here that the classification of artifacts. So like a class of artifacts might be the glass bottles.
Right.
Or the ceramic.
Right.
Or the coins.
Right.
Each of those is a class.
And it can be, and it can, you can make it even finer than that. You can say glass, window glass, bottle glass, drinking glass, you know. You can make your classes whatever you want. So I think it's the archaeologist's job to look at what was done before and try to fit in whatever the new stuff you're going to bring into the methodology and the analysis based on the old. So you can't just go into an area, particularly like Skagway, where lots of stuff was done, and just say, okay, this is how we're going to do it today. This is my idea. No, it doesn't work. You've got to fit it in to what has gone on in the past in order to better understand, not just impose a new regime on something that reinvent the wheel.
Right. So maybe in the past, glass was just glass. And now you have a more refined method.
Yeah.
And you can say, oh, there's window glass and there's bottle glass.
Yeah. And you have 1/4-inch glass and 5/8-inch glass. And you have glass that's amber. And, you know, you can refine it to your heart's content. But at some point, you have to say, what is meaningful? Maybe this isn't meaningful.
Right. And maybe one archaeologist is particularly interested in the glass. So they refine it down to that precise level, whereas the other archaeologist was more interested in the bones and focused on those.
Exactly.
Okay. Because you also then in this paragraph you're talking about minimum number of individual specimens.
Okay, that's one of my favorite topics. You might not have wanted to ask me that. So a minimum number is exactly what it sounds like. And the example we used is one bottle as opposed to 100 glass shards of the same bottle. And I know it best through bones.
Right.
And that's where, because that's where I started out in doing archaeological analysis. And you have to be real careful, because you can really bias an interpretation on the basis of how you are determining the minimum number of individuals. With bones, I'll give you a really easy example. If you have three bone fragments and you know that they are both femurs of a deer, one you can easily tell is right and one is easily left, and the third one is a fragment of either the right or the left. Well, you just have one individual. It's just one individual. Unless it's so obviously, you know, a young one and an old one, or a long one and a, you know, it's just one individual. So, you could really mess up the interpretation by saying, well, there were three. Well, there weren't three. There was probably just one. So that's the minimum number of individuals.
Is one.
Is one.
For a one deer.
One deer.
Right.
Yeah.
But with historic artifacts, like your glass bottle example,
it might not.
You
be
don't know that those 100 pieces are from one bottle, or
you might have an eye. You know, if they're right all there together, and they're exactly the same color and thickness, that's what you might assume.
Okay.
So I think it's the way you do your methodology is really important. You have to say exactly how you're doing your method and why you're doing that, and then people like me who come later on and try to make sense of it can see, okay, was this method correct? Are they inflating the number, you know, by saying there was 100 glass bottles here when there was really only one?
So
methods are important.
So determining the minimum number of individual specimens for an artifact type is determined by the archaeologist on that project. There's not some hard and fast
rule. No, it's every situation is different. And you can have different interpretations. So there's no hard and fast rule. I think, like in any kind of science, you have to be conservative, and you don't want to say there are three deer here when there was really only one, and maybe there really were three. Maybe it was a right from one, a left distal, a left proximal, and there were three. But without really good reason to believe that, we're going to say there's one deer.
Yeah, I was going to say, with the deer example, how do you know the right and left are from the same animal?
You don't know, unless there's some really good reason. Like I said, sometimes you know because of the age of the age of the individual. The bones haven't fused yet, and you can see this was an old right, and this is a subadult left. There were two individuals.
Okay.
So all the data you can bring in order to to actually determine what that thing, that archaeological unit is, will help.
Right, and say with pieces of glass, it might be hard to figure out, but with pottery, ceramics that have the same design,
and you can fit them together.
You can fit them together, and they're broken, and they're, as you say, they're laying close together.
Uh-huh.
That might be easier to figure out than.
Yes.
Nails or shards of glass.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite is Ovi's bags of wood chips.
Oh.
In archaeological collections.
Oh, yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah.
Like, that's always my standard when I'm talking about museum collections.
Oh.
Like, oh, yeah, bags of wood chips.
Great. Yeah. Yeah. At some point in the future, maybe they'll have some way to deal with that. Because, you know, if you get new methods, you're able to get a lot of data from stuff that in the past they couldn't.
Yeah.
So you have to think of that too. Right. So there's sometimes a good reason for them to collect all those soil samples that take up enormous quantities of space in the museum, because somebody's going to figure out what to do with that, and maybe they won't.
Well, there's they might find seeds in it.
Yes, they might find seeds in it. Huh?
At some point in the future. Mm-hmm. Well, are there any other things you can think of about this report or the work you did in Skagway?
Well, I all I wanted to say is that I was really happy to have the opportunity to do this, because it was really a wonderful project, and it came toward the end of my time at the Park Service, so I was happy to have had it to do, and I learned a lot, and I had a good time, and I got to meet with Carl, and that was great. So it was all good. And work with Frank.
Are there any other Park Service projects that you're proud of? You're glad you got to work on?
Well, I had my 11-year project with the mining. I enjoyed that, and that was great. And I got to work do various zooarchaeological projects that I enjoyed doing with Gene Schaefe and Roger Herrett. I got to do some of those. I think the thing that was the best was that I got to do lots of things that I just did because I enjoyed them, and my boss, Ted Burkadahl, was broad-minded and understanding enough to know that it was all important. I got to work with lots of other people, other archaeologists in the state, in different parks and different agencies, in order to make a community of people who are interested in archaeological education. I got to work in the villages. Working in the villages with the kids was the best, because I love those kids were wonderful. So it was all good. It was like, how lucky can you be?
Yeah. What villages did you work in?
I worked in the villages that were in northern Alaska. Let's see, I'm drawing a blank here. Well, one of them I think was Shishimref. Mm-hmm. Villages that were near the parks, I'm literally...
So the northwest region, Bering Lange,
like, Kotzebue, Nome. There was no park near Barrow, so I didn't work near Barrow. But the villages that were near the parks...
So like the western Arctic ones, like Selowit, No Attack.
Yeah, No Attack. No Attack was one.
Kiana, all
that. Yeah, all those. Uh-huh, exactly. Kiana, No Attack. And the way I did that was through money from the Beringian program.
Okay.
So I worked with the Beringian folks and got money to go to the villages and teach the kids about archaeology and have them come out to sites and work on the sites. That was great. That was lots of fun.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was goodwill for the Park Service, because they were involving the community and the kids learned something, and it was all good.
So you said you had all this freedom to do things, and this Skagway report, you were assigned to.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get to pick your own projects, or were they always assigned to you?
This one was a little bit of both. This one was assigned to me. That archaeological mentorship program, I guess I sort of invented that. And it was, actually, the reason that came about was because my job was as the archaeologist for the landmarks. And that was really kind of a tough thing to wrap your mind around, because the landmarks were not always on Park Service land. They were sometimes private, and I was trying to do some exhibit that would show, some display that would show the landmarks. And I can say I did not do a very good job of that, and the parks criticized me. And they were right. And in retrospect, they were right. I didn't do a very good job of that. And then I felt really terrible about it. Like, here I let down, not only did I let down the parks, but it was an opportunity to do something, and I didn't do it right. And I thought, well, what can I do to make up for that? And I just decided, well, the best thing to do would be to go in to the schools and talk to the kids about archaeology, and that would kind of make it right. I don't know if it really did, but it probably helped. So I got the Beringian grant, and then I got to go to the different villages and even bring in Russian students.
Oh, cool.
Because, Beringian was the across the Bering Strait. Yeah. So, you just learn from your mistakes. I made a mistake, and I hope to make it better. And that's how the archaeological mentorship came about.
Do you have a sense of why that landmarks exhibit didn't come out as you had hoped?
I probably was naive in many ways, and I didn't have enough. I mean, I just thought I knew what I was doing, and I didn't know what I was doing. So I think what I learned from that, I'm happy to tell you, is that, any kind of project you do, you have to think about all the different people who are, I guess the word, kind of a catchword, the shareholders. Who are these people? Who are the people in the villages? There are people in the villages who worked on archaeological sites long before there were parks, and they were still there.
Right.
Did I reach out to them? No, I was wrong. You have to reach out to all the people who might have a stake in this. If you've done that, then your project will be much better. You know, you have to realize, who are these people? Think of them in your mind. And the way that our laws are set up and our regulations are good about that, you just have to follow that. You know, that if you have, certainly when it comes to burials or, you know, anything like that, there are specific things you have to do. But I think in general, anybody who has a big project, you have to know who the people involved or who have a stake in it or who are interested in it. Make sure you talk to them, because they're going to tell you something you never thought of.
And do you feel like with this Skagway project that you did that?
I hope I did. I mean, I really tried to, because I've learned from my past mistakes. I hope I did. You know, I talked to all the important researchers, and I went there. I talked to the curators. I talked to the other historic archaeologists. I actually came to Montana on my own
right.
to look at the landmarks. There's Virginia City here. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I mean, you know, I did what I could do.
So you feel like you in this one you learned and you accomplished the goals you set out to.
I think so. Yeah. I hope so.
Good.
I have no regrets, so I guess it's good. I mean, there are projects I have lots of regrets, but this one I don't. So that's a good one.
Yeah. Well, and your example of that landmarks exhibit is one that you have regrets.
Yes, I have lots of regrets, but but I think that the outcome was okay because. I tried to make it better, you know. I didn't just leave it there. I tried to go out and make and repair the damage I'd done.
As I say, I think this book is... I learned a lot.
Oh, good.
It because, as I say, those old... You know, you don't have to wade through 11 different archaeological mm-hmm. reports. Mm-hmm. And it does tie it all together
uh-huh.
nicely. So I'm hoping that it gets used.
I hope so, too. Yes, I do.
So, was there anything else that you wanted to share that when I said, well, I want to come talk to you about Skagway, well, you said, oh, I have nothing to say.
Oh, I guess I have a lot to say. I seem to have a lot to say in my old age. Yeah, I mean, all I can remember is when I was first doing field work in Alaska, and I worked up on the North Slope one summer. And one wonderful Alaskan archaeologist who you probably know, Mike Kunz.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was working at a site with him. It was called, was it the Lisburn Barrow site? And a helicopter landed with a crew of people, reporters. And he was screening, and they stopped him, and they said, and here I am digging my little pit somewhere. And they started talking to him, and he started talking. And it was like, wow. He can just talk about this stuff. I'll never be able to do that. You know, and after you do it for 30 years or more, you can just talk about it because it's so part of you that there's nothing to really think about it. I mean, you think about it, but it's just part of you.
Right.
So I feel like when I retired, I got to the point where I could just kind of talk archaeology.
Yeah, well, I'll say, as an archaeology educator, you have been doing it for...
And somebody the other day wanted me to talk about Alaska, and she goes, well, is this too much to ask? And I looked at her, and I said, I've been talking about Alaska for so many years. If you want me to stop, do it right now, I would have no problem.
we did talk about, you know, the you had fun doing this report and that you like doing research and uh-huh. writing. But were there things that were especially challenging or frustrating on this project?
Challenging? Well, the thing that I didn't like, and maybe that was the challenge, was going through all those 106 compliance reports. Oh, man. And, and trying to understand what it meant. Because there are many different agencies involved in, like I said, drawers and drawers. And that part isn't really fun. I mean, that part is just bureaucratic stuff. But if you really want to understand, I mean, it was necessary. You have to understand, why was it done this way? Well, it was done this way because, you know, they had money to do that building, that corner of that building. That's all they had. Well, if you don't know that, then you wonder, why do they have such a little narrow piece of the archaeology? So you have to know that. But it's not really fun to figure all that out.
Were there any obstacles? You know, people who said, no, don't do this, or people
no.
you contacted didn't want to talk
Everybody
to?
Everybody was helpful. Everybody was great. And the best one was Ted Burkadahl.
Yeah.
He was a person who has a very good friend. He and his wife are very good friends of mine. A very broad view of what anthropology and archaeology is. It encompasses just about everything. So there were few things that I had an idea to do that he, I don't think there was anything I had an idea to do that he didn't let me do. I just could do what I wanted to do because it was all archaeology. It was all public money spent for the public good.
Right. Well, the reason I asked that too is I know, you know, within the Park Service as a bureaucracy, there's competition for funding and for projects, mm-hmm. and if people, other parks or other people in the regional office thought, you know, why are you doing that? That's not a useful project.
Well, there was funding for this, and you know, the money was allocated, but like I said, there was no product.
Right.
So I can't remember. I mean, I didn't have any problems with people or anything.
And there was no, I mean, you say it took you 5 years. Was there pressure that this is taking you too long? You got to work on it faster?
No, because that wasn't really my job. It was sort of, you know, my job was archaeological education and landmarks and writing, writing landmark nominations. Can I branch off on that for just a second? The thing that was frustrating was not this report. The thing that was frustrating to me was I worked on one successful landmark nomination. They're very hard to do, I'll tell you. It's a formula kind of thing.
So they're harder than National Register nominations?
They're like a full-blown, it's a much, much more detailed National Register nomination.
Okay.
It is a National Register nomination. It's just for a landmark. You got to present it in better detail. But so I worked on, one thing I worked on for 5 years, or maybe even more, was the earliest Americans. And it was a theme study. And all the earliest sites that were in Alaska, I researched. And I did lots of stuff. And I wanted to have a document that was ready to go that could be used to do other landmark studies. It was a thematic thing. And there it was. And somebody could use it. And two things that I learned. Lots of this stuff gets buried in file cabinets. And there was one fabulous National Register document that was done, I don't know, maybe in the 70s or 80s. And it was locked in somebody's file drawer. Nobody even knew it. The person who wrote it didn't know it. It had never been advanced to the National Register. It was just there in a file drawer. And it was such a waste of great data. That broke my heart to see that. And the other thing is, I worked on this project that was kind of, okay, this earliest American stuff, this is good, but then the Secretary of the Interior changes, and the Secretary of the Interior has different ideas. We're not doing this stuff anymore. We're doing a whole different thing. He happened to be Latino, and he was interested in those kind of sites. So, okay, well, we do what the Secretary of the Interior tells us to do. I'm not disputing whether that's right or wrong. That's probably just fine, except it's certainly a person who spends a long time working on one thing and then a change of administration. This happens, I'm sure, all the time, every day. But it's frustrating. That part is frustrating because then you have all this time invested in this and you think it's good and it's good stuff, and then no, we're not doing that anymore. We're doing this.
Right.
So to me, that was frustrating. It never happened with this book, but it happened on other projects.
That's kind of what I was wondering with this.
No, this it didn't happen on this.
Because I can imagine that
it could have happened. Yeah, it could have happened, and it probably happens to people all the time. So I'm not complaining personally. Oh, I guess I am complaining personally. Because, you know, you spend a long time and lots of energy, and then done, and it's going to be in that file cabinet in that bottom drawer.
Right, and that's what I was wondering, that the nature of being in a large federal bureaucracy, how much that happens, and
that
how
does
that affects
happen.
Your work.
That happens, and it affects your work, and it certainly affects morale.
Mm-hmm.
And I was always been a very positive person, but I can say it affected my morale.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And what was the relationship like between the regional office and Klondike Park specifically? Do you know?
Well, I think it would depend on if you were talking about the archaeologist or the superintendents, or, you know, everybody comes at the job of doing Park Service work a little bit differently. If you're a superintendent, you have to have all these projects and you have hundreds of thousands of visitors. You have a little bit different view of it than the person who's on the ground digging the hole. You know, I was very fortunate in most cases in that I didn't have to deal with that. It was Ted who had to deal with that. I'm the person who does the education and the research and the writing. He's the person who does the administration and the dealing with, you know, things that are bad, with bureaucratically bad.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm sure there was bad feelings all along the way, but I never got that at all, and not at all. I was removed from that because there was Ted as the filter.
Mm-hmm. Because I know, yeah, in some cases having a regional person working on a localized project may or may not have been as accepted. Or did they appreciate the help from the region, or was it negatively upon?
I probably a little bit of both. I can't tell you exactly. I never got any bad feelings at all with what I was doing. And at least they covered up if they did. I remember one experience I had is that I did a lot of work research-wise in Wrangell St. Elias, mm-hmm. because of the mining sites.
Right.
I'd never been there. And there was nothing, you know, you can't just decide you're going to go. Sometimes you can go, if you're writing a report, you can go to the park and look at it. But I didn't have that opportunity. But I had the opportunity, I can't exactly remember, but I wanted to go to Kennecott because I was writing about it. I knew a lot about it. And I wanted to take my son there. So we went as tourists. We went as tourists. I paid for the whole thing myself. We were walking around and somebody mentioned something and I said, you know, we were there looking around and I'm pointing things out to my son. And they might have said, well, you know a lot. And I said, oh, I work for the regional office. They were just horrified. And they wrote to my boss and said, you didn't tell us she was coming. I was like, oh. And then I have to thank Sandy McDermott, who started this project. She wrote a great email back and said, you have a problem with tourists? You know, do we have to tell you when our employees go as tourists? That's what I was. My son was with me.
Right.
And so there was certainly a friction. But I didn't have to deal with that too much. My pay grade wasn't high enough to deal with that friction.
And on the Skagway one, you were able to at least go there and look around a little bit.
Oh, they were incredibly helpful.
Yeah.
Incredibly helpful, yeah. I had no problem at all. So, I know other people have, but I didn't.
Right. But so the idea of you writing about something that you haven't seen...
Well, perhaps the original archaeologists had a problem with me, but they didn't let me know that. They were very generous. They were very professional. If I reinterpreted or misinterpreted, you know, I'm sorry, but I did it to the best of my knowledge.
Did they have a chance to review this before it got published?
You know, I did. I sent it to them, and I can't exactly remember what happened. But I think I gave them a timeline, and I think that I got some comments, and I think some comments were too late in coming,
mm-hmm.
so they were not incorporated. If I got a comment, I would certainly have changed it.
Right.
But I think that, you know, everything you do, you have to have a timeline.
Right.
And I was going to retire, so I couldn't wait for them forever. So if I didn't get a comment, then I just had to move on.
Right.
So that's a hard part in... it was not really a collaborative effort except with Frank, but you know, if you deal with other people's research, you certainly don't want to step on their feet, and I really tried not to, and if I did, I'm truly sorry. But I didn't hear any negative things from them, and if they said them, then I don't know about it.
Right. Well, as you say, you do have to set time limits
uh-huh.
when it comes to publication and mm-hmm. finishing a project,
mm-hmm.
and you hope people can respond in that time frame.
Uh-huh.
You know, I understand, having written these yes. kinds of things yes. myself, that you can only do what you can do. But it does sound like in this one that you at least getting to walk around Skagway and see the buildings and the places you were writing about, you found that helpful.
Oh yeah. Yes. I mean, you can't do it without doing that.
Right.
Yeah, you must go there.
Okay. So anything else?
No.
That you thought of that when I...
No, I think I did. I didn't know I had all this in my brain because it's been such a long time. It's like gone, you know. I'm one of these people, when I'm done with the project, I'm done. And
right.
I'm just done. And I liked it. I enjoyed it, but I did it.
It's not like you've gone back and reread
because I have other things to think about and curious about, too many other things to dwell on what's there. I have to move on.
Right. Well, thank you.
Oh, you're welcome.
Time, unless there's anything else you
nope.
think about this project or other Park Service projects you worked on.
I just want to say I had a great time in almost all of them. I had a couple bad experiences, but really not very many. Almost all of them were positive. I had a great job, and I think about that.
Do you have any of those bad ones you care to discuss?
Oh, that one about that exhibit I told you. Yeah. That was the only bad one, really. I can't really think of anything. You know, I mean, there were certainly other employees that were hard to deal with, but most of the people I worked with were good, hardworking, intelligent people with lots of integrity. So, you know, how much better than that can you get?
And it sounds like you were a little bit out of the bureaucracy that the Park Service can be known for.
I was out of the bureaucracy. I didn't have to deal with all that, the stuff that, you know, Ted and Sandy had to deal with. I really didn't. I was sort of insulated because as a researcher, you know, I got to do my research, and boy, that was great.
Sounds great.
It was.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.